Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, and we are back with another episode. This is episode 58, and we have a great one planned for you today. We are going to get into Gambino crime family lunatic Nino Gaggi. We're going to talk about his life. We're going to get into his kind of come up in the world of the mafia. We're going to get into his wild time as a capo regime, in which he takes over a very powerful crew, ends up committing murder in control of that crew. We'll talk about his relationship with Roy DeMeo, an individual, Dominic Montiglio, and more. A very fascinating episode coming up here on the show. As always, I urge you, if you enjoy our content, make sure you go follow us on Twitter at SitDown7. It's a great way for you to get news on the show, info on gangsters, and really to communicate with us directly. If you ever have a comment or question, you're welcome to reach out to us through the DM feature and we'll get back to you. Also, I urge you, for everyone listening that enjoys this content, I want to let everybody know, if you don't know, we also have a YouTube channel. And I urge you to go subscribe right now. Go check out our videos. You can find the YouTube in the description of the video that you're listening to this on, or just go to YouTube and search The Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. You'll see all sorts of smaller videos that I do a couple times a week. And I really try to provide a weekly report, not just here on the show, but on YouTube as well. We also have past shows up there and certain interviews and things of that nature. So make sure you go check that out. That is a major part of what we do here on The Sit Down. And I'm noticing that every day we continue to have more and more people subscribe. And I'm hoping that the people that listen to our show and enjoy what we're doing here, go check that out as well. Because as we know, the mafia, organized crime, the drug trade, it never stops. And there's always people to get into. Before we get into the biography this week, which we'll get to, and it'll be a good one, I do want to talk about a little news. And as we were, funny enough, wrapping up the show last week, there was some really interesting information that came in across the wire. As we were wrapping up, there was a big indictment that came down in Fulton County, Georgia, and it alleges that multiple high-end rappers are said to be gang members and the basically capo di tutti capis of a street gang. And what I mean by that is, according to Fulton County, Georgia, and their authorities down there, they went and released a multi-count, widespread indictment against an individual called Jeffrey Williams. Jeffrey Williams also goes by the name Young Thug. Young Thug is a very big rapper. For anyone that's not a rap person or you know, doesn't listen to it, Young Thug is a very high-end rapper. He's a multi-millionaire, multi-platinum recording artist, a guy that has really become an influential figure in his generation of like that trap hip-hop music down in the South. This is a guy that has all sorts of success, and they would allege down there that this individual is the head of an organization called YSL, aka Young Slime Life. Feds would, or not the feds, but the authorities would indicate that the syndicate basically operated as an organized crime gang, and a pattern of racketeering activity and conducting, participating in the enterprise, allowed money to be illegally attained as well as property, and it all flowed upward to people like Jeffrey Williams. Now, Williams, alongside two dozen other members, were all indicted. And what's interesting about this indictment is, I think first glance, I thought it was a Fed indictment, and it is not. Generally, when you see RICO conspiracies, we'll hear them, with the mafia. And it's generally the federal government that rains down these indictments. This was actually brought by the Fulton County District Attorney and the authorities in that county of Georgia and Atlanta. The district attorney would allege that Young Thug and an individual called Sergio Kitchens, a.k.a. Gunna, who was also a big-time rapper, were basically the leaders of this group. They were all hit with RICO. They would also contend they commenced to do havoc on our community since 2012. According to Atlanta Police Chief Rodney Bryant, he would call Young Thug, quote, one of the top offenders who needed to be taken off our Atlanta streets. These individuals are committing conservatively 75 to 80% of all violent crime in our community. It doesn't matter your notoriety or fame. If you come to Fulton County, Georgia, commit crimes, you're going to be a target and a focus of the DA's office. How about that? Very interesting. All of these people associated with this are facing long prison sentences. And it goes back to the question of, at what point do you leave the streets alone? And we see this. Look, the people we talk about on this show, for the most part, are criminals at the end of the day. They commit, assaults and murders and drug dealing and extortion and loan sharking and all this stuff. And that's who they are. They grew up around it. That's who they are. But a lot of the people we're discussing are not multi-platinum recording artists that have talent and have made millions, quite frankly, in the music industry. You have to wonder what calls someone to the streets so much that even in the level of success that these people have had, why they continue to commit crimes. Officials would also say the gang was believed to have been started in like 2012. And you have a couple major crimes here. I mean, you have firearms offenses, robbery, theft, assault, conspiracy to commit murder, witness intimidation, all sorts of things, drug activity, threats of violence, preserving and protecting your reputation and power through the posting of illegal messages, images, videos, and songs, willingness to engage in violence. There's a lot going on here. And you know what they're going to use in the indictment? You know what they're going to use in the court case, the trial? They're going to use lyrics, and they're going to use a lot of lyrics. And they're going to try to play that, this individual, Mr. Williams, used his music to play a crucial role in his behavior. This is not the first time we've seen this over the last 10 years in the rap game. All sorts of rappers, some are doing long prison sentences due to the fact that they continue to commit crimes. People like A.R. Ab out of Philadelphia, people like Casanova out of Brooklyn, people like Tekashi 6ix9ine have continued to put themselves in bad situations because they want to, continue to commit crimes as they make it to the top of the food chain in the rap game. It is completely odd. It makes very little sense to me, and I'll never understand it. It's something that we're going to have to keep track of. Obviously, I was surprised that this is not a federal indictment, but this is not going to be easy. And as the police chief alluded to, just because you are a rapper does not mean you are not above the law. And, this is something where they're going to not only do some digging into who you are, but they're going to have a lot of this stuff served up on a platter through interviews, through music, through lyrics, and it's going to be a problem. Now, the big thing that we need to also remember is Mr. Williams, aka Young Thug, did not get bail, which you don't normally see. Usually that's only in murder cases. This isn't ideal if you're them. The district attorney, Fannie Willis, would also say, we expect that in coming days and months that we'll bring RICO indictments against other gang members to make sure we rid them from our society. There's one individual named in the indictment is the same individual accused of shooting Atlanta police officer David Rogers six times in February and seriously wounding him. So there's a lot that's going on here. And the problem for Mr. Thug is he's at the top of the group. And the feds or the feds, I keep saying that the Fulton County officials continue to say he is the top guy. So something to keep track of. If you're going to go out and make millions, it's probably best that you stay away from the streets. Isn't the goal to get out of the streets? Why are you still in them? We'll see what happens. Now, remember, these are all alleged crimes, but we'll definitely keep track as to what is going on in this indictment. All right, let's get into the reason we are here. I want to speak about the very interesting Nino Gaggi. And I've had a couple of people reach out about Nino and, what are you going to do, Nino? I want to talk about Nino. So let's get into it. Let's talk a little Gambino crime family. Nino Gaggi on the sit down. Antonino Frank Gaggi was born August 7th, 1925. He would actually grow up on the Lower East Side, East Village, that area of Manhattan. He was the youngest of three kids. And actually, growing up, his father was a barber. His family came from Sicily. They're from Palermo. And his father emigrated and kind of started into the trade early. He became a barber, and he'd run a barbershop. And young Nino learned the value of a dollar by kind of sweeping up, shoe shining, making sure things were stocked, that sort of thing. And, you know, you would have to think, you know, kind of right away, okay, pretty decent family, right? You have a father who's a hard worker, you know, a barber can make decent money. We all need our haircut, obviously. His mother was a seamstress. She'd actually work until she gave birth to Nino, and then she'd become a homemaker. So for Nino, he had a pretty decent childhood for the most part. Now, one of the interesting things about Nino Gaggi, and one thing we always know, is there's always a little bit more than meets the eye. And that's exactly what would happen. One of Angelo Gaggi, Nino's father, one of his cousins, was an individual, Frank Scalise. And if you know anything about the early Gambino crime family, Frank Scalise was a founding member of the family. He was a high-end individual. And Nino gravitated towards his cousin very, very much in his early adolescence. By eighth grade, he would actually drop out of school, and he'd actually begin working more feverishly in his father's barber business. But he would be on the street earning money as well. And he'd actually join a street gang in the East Village called the 10th Street Mob. And he idolized his cousin Frank. He knew that, you know, in that neighborhood, there were gangsters. It was a time where, look, in the early 40s, gangsters were everywhere. New York was full. It was a potpourri of gangsters, whether it was Manhattan, whether it was Harlem, whether it was Brooklyn, whether it was the Bronx. It really didn't matter. Gangsters were everywhere. And he was already running the streets anyway, making extra money, using it for gambling and doing loan sharking and things like that. He begins to kind of realize that, you know what, I'm coming under the wing of my cousin. He's obviously very powerful. I want to be like him. I don't want to work in a barbershop like my father. I want to go out and do things. And he came under the control of his cousin. He would drop out of school. And in his early 20s, ultimately, he's being schooled. He's learning the business. He had already been gambling, as I said, and he quickly learned how to give out loans and collect and, you know, steal things. He was very adept, Nino Gaggi, at making money. And that's something that, you know, we've talked before on this show about how do you, when you're a gangster, who are the ones that are truly remembered? How do you become, you know, a Tony Salerno? How do you become a Carlo Gambino? How do you become a Tony Accardo? You have to have the ability to make a lot of money, and you also have to have the ability to kill people. And if you could do both, you're going to be a very important part of the New York Mafia. It's that simple. And Nino Gaggi was, in my opinion, probably the antithesis of what I just said. He made a lot of money, and he was a very demented person. He was very willing to kill. He had that in him. By his early 20s, he had a fledgling loan business, and his cousin Frank Scalise would actually get him a no-show job. He'd allow him to report taxable income and focus on more nefarious things. He could put his efforts into more illustrious underworld things like stealing cars and creating schemes to make money on stolen Cadillacs and loan sharking and all sorts of different things. And by the 50s, as I said, one of the big businesses Nino Gaggi got in was the stolen car business. Basically, what he was doing is he was manufacturing fake registrations and VIN numbers and stealing cars, recirculating all those pieces of information, and then selling the cars out of state and even into Mexico. So he was making a lot of money. And that's something that, you know, when we figure out and find out who Roy DeMeo is, Roy DeMeo was very involved in stolen cars as well. This was big business back in the day. You can make a lot of money on Cadillacs and things like that. It's something that I think, you know, you don't hear a ton about stolen cars in the Gambino crime family. So this is something that made them good amounts of money. Money began flowing in. And by this point, Nino Gaggi had to start realizing that he had more mouths to feed, not necessarily in his own family, but he was very close with his sister, Marie. And Marie would actually have a son in 1947 called Dominic, and he would help raise her son. During the 50s, things continued to go better and better for Nino Gaggi. He would continue to ascend higher and higher, and he would begin to more and more get more respect inside the Gambino crime family. The problem for the Gambino crime family was there was a lot going on in the family itself. As we know, in 1957, Albert Anastasia is killed inside the Park Sheraton Hotel in Manhattan, and a revolt has begun. Carlo Gambino takes over. They would also get some really bad news, Nino would. His cousin, Frank Scalise, was actually shot and killed outside a fruit stand in the Bronx. And this would hit Nino hard. He had to realize that he was a grown man now, and he had to figure this out and take some retribution for this. It was found out through many people in the mafia that for most, the belief was that an individual, James Squillanti, killed his cousin. And Squillanti was an assassin for Albert Anastasia and a very devout loyalist. This would actually be found out as well by Joe Villaggi. He would point this out in his testimony that Squillanti did, in fact, kill Frank Scalise. And for Nino Gaggi, this would be one of the first pieces of work he would deal with. And obviously you don't blame him. He goes and kills one of his family, you know, someone that killed his family member. You know, you don't really have any reason to believe that he shouldn't have. In 1960, Squillanti would disappear. And according also to Dominic Montiglio, he as a teen would be told by Gaggi that he in fact did kill Vincent James Squillanti, interestingly enough. And look, for that, he would be inducted into the Gambino crime family. And he would create a little crew. He would start to have people around him. And this is where he would meet an individual named Roy DeMeo. DeMeo was kind of an up-and-comer. He was making a lot of money stealing cars in Brooklyn. That was his area. And Gaggi had already had that huge loan business. He was making a lot of money. And he basically goes to DeMeo and says, hey, let's work together here. You know, come under my wing. I'll teach you the names of the game. We'll be a powerhouse in Brooklyn. Because by this point, Nino Gaggi was living in Bath Beach. He lived on Cropsey Avenue. And, you know, for Roy DeMeo, that was not far off from where he was from in that Flatlands area. So this was kind of a powerhouse coming together. And for the Gambino family, what this meant was a lot of money that would be flowing up to the top level. Business ventures were fruitful. They would eventually move in, though, to a really, really good business, the porn business. And look, I've talked about this at length on other shows that we've done. On our YouTube channel, I've done some digging into the porn business. I've done some episodes on an individual, Michael Zaffirano. I talked about Robert DiBernardo, an individual that was from the Gambino family that was very involved with the porn trade. Through a person called Paul Rothenberg, Nino Gaggi and Roy DeMeo muscle in to porn. They start kind of becoming silent partners, if you will, in the business. And when I say silent partners, I don't believe Mr. Rothenberg actually wanted any partners, but they just kind of muscle in and said, we're your fucking partners, get over it, or we'll just get rid of you. The problem is eventually Paul Rothenberg gets arrested. And they get spooked. So DeMeo is ordered by Gaggi to kill Paul Rothenberg. And this would start a long career. In fact, as many would say, and I think many would agree to what I'm about to say, the most productive killer in the history of the mob is Roy DeMeo. It's that simple. This was his first kill, 1973, Paul Rothenberg. That was that. He would start his career, and they were now kind of joined at the hip. This would kind of set off a couple of major kills for Nino Gaggi. Also killed in the mid-70s was a person called Vincent Governera. Governera was a neighborhood boxer who 12 years previously insulted Nino Gaggi. And as we know in the mob, you know, they might not do anything initially, but one thing about the mob, it's like prison. They don't forget, right? You may forget, but they don't forget. And they would actually try to kill Governor. It wouldn't work. They'd eventually get him again and ultimately kill him. He would disappear in the mid-70s. Also, a pretty important killing would happen as well. In 1976, Nino Gaggi is building a vacation home in Florida. And he has an electrical contractor, George Byram, in the Miami area that was doing the electrical work on his house. Now, one thing we know about a vacation home is it is vacant for large parts of the year, right? So, like, let's say you have a house on the Jersey Shore. You may only go there between June and September. The rest of the year, the house is vacant. Maybe it's rented or maybe it's just sitting there. George Byram gets a bright idea. He believes, hey, these are tourists. They're not going to be here between, you know, whenever. I know a robbery crew. I'm going to tip them off that this individual is gone and in New York for large amounts of time. Bad idea. Okay. This may work on like an unsuspecting tourist, but I don't think George Byram quite knew who Nino Gaggi was. Nino finds out about this and instructs DeMeo to take a trip down to Florida and get rid of George Byram. Now, one thing they do is they connect with an individual called Tony Plate Pilate. Now, Tony Plate is someone that many people have never heard of, frankly. But in my estimation, probably outside of Gaggi and DeMeo, is probably one of the biggest psychopaths in the history of the Gambino family. This is a guy that allegedly bit someone's face off. I mean, they called him the Pit Bull. He was a mangy little guy. I mean, little individual, but he had a lot of fear waged into people. And he instructs Pilate and DeMeo to go kill this person, George Byram. Now they kill him inside a hotel room, a place called the Diplomat Hotel. Now the goal was they were going to dismember him inside the shower. The problem was during the attempt to dismember the body, they're interrupted outside the room after a crew of construction workers is trying to fix some faulty air conditioning units. So they have to kind of leave. They put the do not disturb sign on the door and flee. The corpse is ultimately discovered by a motel maid. So this wasn't great. Now, didn't really matter much because it's not like they put the, it's not like they had a hotel room, put it in their names or something. But this was the kind of stuff they were doing. I mean, they did what they had to do. Now, look, I will say this. I guess I try to make the point that certain people need to be killed. Look, you rob someone's home or attempt to have thieves rob someone's home. I guess I understand it. But I'm not going to go too deep into that. But by this point, remember, Dominic Montiglio, Nino Gaggi's nephew, is very much involved in the life. He actually went over to Vietnam and in the late 60s would come home and really go right in. As we know, a lot of people that went to war at that time were you know, had the PTSD that we now know of. And Dominic really went right into the life. It was something that I think for him worked perfectly, kind of like the Nicky Scarfo, Philip Leonetti connection. So Dom's kind of in the life. And ultimately, in 1976, as we know, Carlo Gambino passes away and he passes the torch before he dies to his cousin, Paul Castellano, who is made boss of the family. Now, Neil de la Croce slots in as the underboss. This would be good news for Nino Gaggi. He would be promoted to capo of Paul Castellano's old crew. Now, the crew itself was interesting. It would have, obviously, Roy DeMeo and Dominic Montiglio. And it's funny because DeMeo would often lament that he didn't want to be seen with members of the crew because they weren't on his level, according to him. And they weren't. Roy DeMeo was a massive earner. He was a massive killer for the Gambino crime family. He was kind of crazy, though. And I think, as we know, Paul didn't really like DeMeo. He thought he was a loose cannon, but I think Paul realized, hey, if I need someone killed, he can do it. A couple of the people involved in the crew, as I said, were Roy DeMeo, Dominic Montiglio, Frank Bonino, a guy called Greg DePalma. And I mentioned that name because we've heard of him before He, if you remember during the Jack Garcia interview we did, Craig De Palma was actually the individual that many years later, Jack Garcia would befriend and ultimately go undercover again. So Greg De Palma was in that crew, James Eppolito Jr. and Sr. And I say that name as well, because that is a connection to a previous person in our shows as well. They would be the cousins and nephew of Ralph Eppolito, or brother, some sort of family connection. Now, Ralph Eppolito's son would be Louis Eppolito, the rogue cop that would ultimately become a hitman for Anthony Casso and become a mafia cop. Remember that story. So it was kind of a ragtag group of guys. One thing about Greg De Palma, definitely a good earner, but a problem with keeping his mouth shut. It's funny, when Greg De Palma was made, he made 6 phone calls to 6 different people after the hit to tell them I got made and I love Nino, and just a major caquerón, if you will. And a caquerón is, you know, for people that don't speak any Italian slang, a caquerón would be a chatterbox, someone that never shuts up. So things were good for Nino Gaggi. He had his own crew. He was very powerful. He's making a lot of money. He was offing people that needed to go. He had inroads in different businesses and industries. He was a silent partner in a lot of things, had his weekly tributes coming in, and was also making a ton of money in the loan sharking business. And by this point, he had his nephew, Dominic Montiglio, collecting loans for him. On June 7, 1978, bad news would come to Nino Gaggi. He would be hit with an indictment as far as racketeering was concerned. And the good thing about Gaggi, the one thing we have to talk about, he was very careful. This is a guy that really was a gangster through and through. He never talked on the phone. He never mentioned anything. He was very adept at never being caught. And this would actually help him out, because a lot of this case was made on wiretaps. And this would really involve some connections into theaters and things like that. The problem, though, was a lot of the evidence came from wiretap conversations, and they could never catch Nino on any wiretaps. In December of 1978, he'd be cleared of all charges and beat the rap. Now, the late 70s would come some more problems, particularly in the family itself. By this point, DeMeo is a major earner, right? He has all sorts of rackets. And, you know, he continues to ask himself, you know, why am I not being made a member of the family? He kind of felt like kind of an outcast in the group. Why doesn't Castellano make me? What's the problem here? I'm doing everything I'm asked. And by this point, DeMeo and Gaggi are making a lot of money shipping cars to the Middle East. We talked about that in the DeMeo show. He was making a lot of profit from these rackets. But one thing that Roy DeMeo was also doing was he was selling large amounts of drugs, particularly cocaine and marijuana, plus other pills and things. And this was an issue, because like the Gaggi crew, DeMeo was breaking a prohibition that Paul Castellano had against selling drugs. As we know, deal and die, as they say. And this was a major issue. And this could have lended the fact of why DeMeo wasn't being made. There would be a problem that would set in the late 70s. The capo, one of the members of the crew, James Eppolito, who we talked about, James Eppolito Sr., he would make a beef to Castellano that they were selling drugs. And he knew that because Eppolito's son, James Jr., got into a beef with DeMeo over drug profits in a deal going awry. Now, I guess to try to mask what his own son had did, he just said, well, yeah, he did it, but so did they. Eppolito would claim DeMeo had cheated his son out of money, I guess. Now, Eppolito would accuse Gaggi of being a rat as well, which is something that's kind of a no-no. And I think ultimately, Paul Castellano just kind of said, you know what? I'm better off with DeMeo and Gaggi than I am with you. They make way more money than you. And at the end of the day, your son's selling drugs. He shouldn't be doing that anyway. So I'm going to side, you know, with the better of the wrongs. And I'm going to side with DeMeo and Gaggi. Now, Castellano would kind of set that they would have a meeting and they would kind of dole this out. So Gaggi and DeMeo pick up the Eppolito brothers on October 1st, not the Eppolito brothers, the son and father, on October 1st, 1979. They'd be driving on the Belt Parkway when the son who's driving the car is told by his father, he gets a bad kind of whiff and says, hey, pull over. But it wouldn't matter. Once they got into that car, they were dead men. And in the back seat sat DeMeo and Gaggi. As they pulled off to a rest stop, the son and father would be shot multiple times. They would then exit the car and escape on foot. The problem was a witness saw what went on and alerted an off-duty cop. Nino Gaggi would get into a firefight with the police officer, ultimately being shot in the neck, which obviously wasn't good. He'd be arrested at the scene. Weirdly enough, he would actually, although charged with murder and attempted murder of a police officer, he would only be convicted of assault. Now, I had trouble finding info about this. I wonder how this happened, but he made off. I guess there was no way to prove that he did something or he wasn't seen actually doing the hit. He was able to beat it. There were no other witnesses, and it worked out for him. But I want to kind of go back to one thing that Dominic Montiglia would talk about in an interesting excerpt that would be talked about in the book Murder Machine by Jerry Capici and Mustaine. In the book, Montiglia would tell them that Nino Gaggi would say that when Della Croce had gotten out of prison on Thanksgiving of 79, he agreed to go along with the edict that Castellano, you know, would be the boss, he'd be the underboss, and that they were going to make Gaggi capo. But just in case, Nino said, so they set a meeting up. They were going to go reveal this information to him during some sort of session at his home in Bath Beach. Nino would tell him, though, that he had taped a gun under the kitchen table and told Dominic to position himself in a window upstairs and watch the comings and goings with an M2 automatic rifle that he had picked up from DeMeo. The instructions were that if Dominic heard shooting downstairs, he was to shoot anyone who came out of the house. If the shooting went Paul and Nino's way, no one would be leaving. If he did not, they would be dead. So Dominic should shoot anybody who tries to make it out of the driveway. Quote, don't let any of those cocksuckers get away alive, he wrote. So they were worried of Neil Della Croce. They worried that, you know, he may have been upset about all this and Nino was kind of Paul's guy. And they kind of were a little worried that Neil may not accept the edict that he was going to be underboss and not boss. So kind of interesting story. And I will tell you now, one of the great books, I get asked all the time about books about the mafia. One of the great books, I don't think I need to tell you, is Murder Machine by Gene Mustaine and Jerry Capici. Terrific book. Just a really interesting look into a group of butchers who committed all sorts of gruesome crimes, but definitely an interesting look into that life. Now, once he gets 5 to 15 years, Nino goes away. You know, that's a decent prison sentence. It's like a decade, basically. The thing is, in jail, he would bribe a juror who would make claims of there was misconduct on the part of Nino Gaggi's attorneys that prosecuted him, and he'd actually be granted a release. Nino Gaggi was adept at staying out of prison, like forever, for the most part. He's released in 1981, but by this point, in those year and a half or so, a lot of things happened. There was a lot of dissent. A lot of things are going on at the DeMeo group. They were having their own problems. Certain members are being arrested and starting to flip. And Dominic Montiglio had fled New York City. The nephew was gone. He had, by this point, become addicted to drugs, and he was out. He left. Now, obviously, as we know, Roy DeMeo would ultimately be killed in 1983 after many believed, due to some of the things that he had did or that he would become an informant, he was killed in 1983. Don Montiglio would eventually return to New York City. He was looking to collect some debts where he's arrested. And at this point, Dominic Montiglio had really it all that he could throw at the government and get out of his crimes. And he betrayed the person that really had raised him, quite frankly. You know, I don't think there's anything that Dominic Montiglio didn't do willingly. Remember, he was a grown man. Now, keep in mind, he was groomed as a child. This is one of the small cases. We saw this with Filianetti and Nicky Scarfo. I think the difference between Montiglio was he really had kind of went on his own way. He ended up going to Vietnam. He came home kind of entrenched in the mafia and decided to join. He basically betrayed his uncle. He decides to cooperate and flip against Nino Gaggi and on multiple members of the Gambino crime family, including Paul Castellano. In February of 1983, Nino Gaggi is indicted on multiple counts, including running a stolen car ring. And he would eventually have another trial where he would be on the hook for 25 murders between the 70s and 80s. A couple members, including Henry Borelli, would ultimately be convicted of two murders. Joe Testa and Anthony Center were found guilty of 10 murders in the second trial. So those guys would go away. Nino Gaggi, in March of 86, would be convicted of conspiracy in the car case and get 5 years. Now, the goal of the government was to use that second trial to get him on everything. Now, during all this, Castellano is arrested as well. He's arrested in 1983, and he would eventually get bail and return to the streets. But as we know, in 1985, Big Paul Castellano, as he's awaiting trial, is murdered in front of Sparks Steakhouse. The truth of the matter was, whether Paul was killed or not, he was going to get life in that case. So it really wouldn't have mattered. But John Gotti decides, you know what? I'm not going to take the chance. He's gone. That was that. Now, during the facing of the second trial for Nino Gaggi, Nino Gaggi would actually complain to the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, that he, during a transfer to MDC for a second trial, he was experiencing chest pain. He would tell a guard, and the quote, guard did nothing. Now, it'd be widely speculated that Gaggi may have survived his heart attack if the prison personnel had acted sooner. He was sent to the hospital ultimately, and on April 17th, 1988, Nino Gaggi would die of a heart attack. Weirdly enough, and subsequently, Nino Gaggi's wife would actually sue the BOP for negligence, assisted by the testimony of several other inmates. And this would spark a major controversy that would actually result in better medical conditions in different New York prisons and federal prisons. So the government never actually got to convict him for his crimes. Now, he died in prison, which I guess for the government is the ultimate goal, or to serve a long prison sentence and die down the road. He served a couple of years and ultimately died in prison. Though Nino Gaggi was never actually committed and did long prison sentences, he had for the most part made out. Now, we have to look back at the large run of the Nino Gaggi crew, who was really under the control of DiMeo and all these lunatics. I mean, we know that Roy DiMeo likely killed 50 or more people. The DiMeo crew was a grisly group. They may have committed up to 200 murders. I don't think that's out of the question. They killed everybody from, you know, rats to child molesters to people that deserve to die, to, dealers, to crew members who got out of line, to people that didn't listen, to people that had to go, all sorts of different people, innocent people. Many people were killed. And, you know, this, as we said in the DiMeo, this was the most violent crew in the history of the mafia. And the person that orchestrated this crew was Nino Gaggi. He was the mentor, really, of Roy DiMeo. They made a lot of money together. And look, I think at the end of the day, whether we all know Gaggi and the DiMeo crew were volatile, violent lunatics, we can say this, though, when we're talking strictly about mafia members, they were, you know, as gutter as it gets. They made a lot of money, particularly Nino Gaggi. They had a long run. They killed a lot of people, and they were very feared, greatly feared. In fact, I don't know if there was a more feared crew than them. Nino Gaggi was the guy that really orchestrated this entire crew, a guy that had grown up fairly good. I mean, he had a father and mother that were married. They were in a decent business, but it was really his cousin, Frank Scalise, that brought him into the life. And as we know, when you join the life, you very rarely look back. I don't know of anyone that joined the life for a year or two and said, well, I don't know. I don't really like this. I'm going to go do something else. Doesn't really work like that. They may do that many years later when they cooperate or something, but once you join the life, the thought is, this is a great life and I want to be a part of it. I don't want to do anything else. Nino Gaggi is a guy that, when we look back, we actually could probably say we don't talk enough about. On this show, we kind of rate gangsters on the level of how successful were you? You know, in most of the levels, I mean, Nino made a lot of money. He was powerful. He was a capo, very rich, very connected, knew and was very close with higher ups in that family, was called upon and was very feared, spent very little time in jail. But, you know, he lived a pretty long life. I mean, you know, he died in 88, was born in 25. Mid-60s, you know, a little young, but that was the life. Who knows? If he doesn't have a heart attack, he lives way longer probably. Now he goes to prison and accepts his sentence. He's a stone-cold gangster in every word. And I think, quite frankly, when we look at the American Mafia, I think the perfect definition of the American Mafia is Nino Gaggi. It's pretty simple. This was a guy that was still committing murders as a capo, which is not normal. When he killed the Eppolito father-son duo, he was a capo. That's very rare. And he beat the rap a couple of times. Got out of jail for something that, you keep in mind, he killed two people and attempted to kill a cop, got 5 to 15 years, ultimately served about a year and a half. So that's that. Nino Gaggi this week on the sit-down. As always, I hope you enjoyed the show. I always enjoy bringing you it. I always enjoy chatting. I always enjoy going over these people. And, you know, we just keep moving along to the next week. I will ask you guys, as we wrap up the show, I'm going to need your help for this. I did a really terrific interview a couple of months ago with an individual named Robert Rosso. Robert Rosso served 24 years in federal prison. He became very close with the likes of Carmen Persico, Tommy Reynolds, Jimmy Ida, Bernie Madoff. Do you guys want to hear the interview? I was thinking about posting it on next week's show. Send me a DM, contact me if you think we should put that show out. We put it out on YouTube, but I know there are many people that have not heard it. So I felt like maybe we should run that next week. We'll see. As always, though, let me know what you think. Make sure you leave us a 5-star review if you haven't on our podcast platform. Make sure you leave us a review. Make sure you check out our sponsors and make sure you interact with us. We don't ask you to pay anything for this. We ask you that you show love, tell your family and friends, tell people that might enjoy it, and go follow us on Twitter and check us out on YouTube. Just search The Sit Down, a Mafia History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.